I cut the Google AdWords budget by 60% for the last 6 months. And I have not seen an incremental decrease in the amount of leads I send over to sales. I actually see an increase in quality of what we get over because we've done the right targeting through ABM. Like our organic social is through the roof. That is our number one lead generator for us.
Welcome to Growth Notes, presented by InBeat Agency. Each week, we discuss the essentials of D2C marketing, paid growth, and influencer strategies. Hear from consumer marketing industry leaders who provide transformative insights and share innovative advertising tactics that enhance e-commerce success.
Welcome to the Growth Note podcast. Today, I'm joined with Christelle Flau from Fabric, and she is the CMO over there. And we're going to nerd out on demand generation, go-to-market strategies, and what the folks there are all about. Thanks for coming on the show. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks so much, David. Thanks for saying my name correctly.
Yeah, so we were speaking before the recording. It's a French name. So being from Quebec, I speak French. So we can get into it. One of the first things that I really found interesting in our initial discussion was your background in sports and environment and how it brought you to where you are today and how it's part of your marketing identity. So we can start there, riff about that. And I'm curious to learn more.
Yeah, for sure. I actually got my master's in sports marketing at the University of Memphis. And I thought I wanted to go be like not on the sports agent side, but deal with sports sponsorships. Got to work at FedEx. Got to manage some really fun things like the FedEx St. Jude Golf Classic, the Fiesta Bowl, things that are pretty well recognized and working for a brand that is super well recognized, right? And then I moved out to California and I quickly realized getting any job in sports is much like a hierarchy, right? You end up working in ticketing and then you graduate to something else. And I was like, I live in Silicon Valley. All these people are making all this money in tech. Let's see if I can go into that. And right when that happened, the first bubble burst. And so I ended up in environmental marketing, which was super interesting for me. I worked at a small environmental consulting company. I was the marketing department, right? I was a marketing coordinator reporting directly into the CEO. But what was fascinating about that space is that there was always demand, right? There's always something to clean up. There's a clean room that always has to get designed. There's always noise issues, right? Noise abatement, all that stuff. So I got to learn a lot about the environment and like consulting and all of that stuff. But I also got to learn every single piece of marketing from PR to events to creating a website. They didn't have a website when I joined, installing Salesforce for the first time. Right? Like getting all of those core pieces, I think. And that is what actually got me to a point of, I know how all of the marketing pieces are supposed to work together. So with the sports marketing background, doing events and events like at a really high scale brand, really understanding how a brand is supposed to show up consistently. And then right after that, learning how all of the marketing pieces are supposed to work together, I think really allowed me to have a solid base to start my career. And now as a CMO, I look back and I'm like, wow, I'm just doing all those things I did when I first got out of college, just at a larger scale.
Yeah, that's what happens, right? When you get into a startup, four people company, you get given a director title, which you might have had. Did you have a director title at that point?
No, well, I was a coordinator and I remember negotiating like after a year, I think it was there for about 3.5 years. And after a year and a half of being there, I was like, I would like a promotion. I remember the CEO looking at me, the only place you could go would be CEO, right? Because I reported directly to him and I was like, oh, but could I be a director at least? I feel like I'm way more than a manager. I think I ended up becoming a director. But yeah, it was really funny because it was just anything that no one else wanted to do in the company ended up becoming marketing's problem, which was my problem.
And then that's where you learn the most, to be honest, when you're doing everything like that and you're just on the field figuring problems one after the other and just nobody knows what to do. So it's, and you have no resources, and that's the beauty of it.
Yeah. And you just figure it out yourself. I had no idea how to write a press release. I had no idea how to do an office opening. Like at one point we wanted to pivot industries because we served the semiconductor industry. And that took a little bit of a, obviously a hit when the bubble burst. And it was like, what's like a what's another industry we could go after that has a lot of regulations? And so biotech was just starting in the Bay Area. So we started going after biotech companies. So this was my brilliant idea, right? Find something that's adjacent. So the CEO, great, start calling into biotech companies and setting up meetings. So like I was in BDR, it's like literally had the white pages. I'm like, let's call this company and see if they need a clean room or something. It definitely makes you learn pretty quickly to think on your feet and pivot. And one minute you're making phone calls and the next minute you're writing a press release. And then in the afternoon, you're writing website copy.
Yeah, the good old days of learning, right? It's where you learn. Yeah, that's where you learn. And then I'm curious, what did you get from that period specifically that now is just part of your marketing identity? You go to Fabric and you just go back to these playbooks that you've played. I'm curious, what does that look like?
Yeah, I think the big one for me is around communication. And I think especially when you're Department of One, you have to bring people along, right? If you want to change something or if you want to try a different idea, this goes back to FedEx. I remember one of the sponsorships I had was the Liberty Bowl, which at the time was the last bowl game of the year, right? Like it was literally the last game that was played. And it was in 1999. So it was welcoming Y2K and there was all this buzz around it. And it was one of those programs that was just defunct almost. Like they would just give away tickets to the employees. They really didn't do anything around it. And I had this idea because it was FedEx and I'm delivering the next century, right? Could do something pretty fun around that and have a FedEx truck come in and deliver the football to the game. And the amount of communication that I had to learn how to do at 22 years old, all the way up to the CMO and even the executive staff of trying to coordinate, getting a FedEx truck, was it going to fit in the stadium? How do we get somebody that's on the front line, that's a delivery guy, to want to go do it? Just really started to hone my skills around communicating and convincing people that this was going to be a good idea. So that I think I've taken, I took that into that environmental job because they didn't have a website. So how do you convince a bunch of consultants to create a website? And I still do that today, right? Like I have the same sort of conversations, especially at a startup of, you know what? Maybe let's not do it the way we've always done it, but let's try something different. And you really have to bring people along and get people excited and almost be that cheerleader and convincing people it's going to work. So I think from a core skill perspective, that's one thing I learned pretty early on that I still lean on today.
I feel like everything you boil down comes down to communication in life. It just becomes the core of everything. It always comes back to communication. And I know the Fabric, I mean, you can tell the story. They brought you to change positioning. You guys did a big transition into a new kind of platform and the way at least that you package it, because it's not like you're changing the feature set, obviously, but it becomes a communication challenge. And I'm curious, why were you brought on and what does that challenge look like and how are you tackling it?
Yeah, for sure. This space is pretty interesting, right? So it's e-commerce and it's a pretty crowded space. You think of brands that probably people know, like Shopify, Salesforce Commerce Cloud, Magento, which is part of Adobe now, and being a startup in a space that's pretty saturated and already pretty established is a little bit difficult, right? Because you're competing with a lot more money, a lot more history, and trying to tell a story in a different way. And so I think one of the reasons I was brought in was, how do we go tell that story in a very unique way and educate the market on what that actually means? So if you look at where we've spent the last probably 9 months of our marketing is really around telling the story and amping up our content game. Every marketer you've probably ever talked to is like, content is king. Content is still king, right? That's where everybody gets their information. And that's what we've tried to do is like nail the story. What's the story that resonates? We did a bunch of testing and that took a good 9 months. And I think we're finally at that point of we found the thing that's the differentiator. That's what we want to lean into. And that is going to be now the next phase of this is really amping up that story and using things like LinkedIn and social, our press to really tell that story while the sales team and everybody else does the groundwork to be able to get into these accounts. So I think that's why I was brought in and that's what we've been doing and focused on. It's funny because my career is really demand gen, but this is that step as a demand gen person you just take it for granted sometimes if you've got really good brand coverage. But when you don't have it, demand gen becomes really hard. It's an uphill battle. So I've slowed down demand gen. Let's nail the story, get the air cover first. And then next year, you'll see us really start to amp up the demand gen.
And it's such a hard rock to move, positioning and whatnot, because it feels like you're doing nothing concrete, right? You're doing all these, you know, user studies and, you know, listening to recordings and what's the language they're using. But once you get it right and the sales calls start landing and people are getting it and they're buying into it, the impact is massive. But kudos to you, because 9 months into that, it feels like you're doing nothing. You're not doing events. You're not running. It's just, it's paralyzing.
I know. I tell the team all the time, I know it feels like we're walking through mud right now, but I guarantee you, once we get to this point, my big objective for next year is to create a brand that creates market pull, right? Like, how do we start to get folks to come to us? And if you don't do that hard work first, it gets really hard then to do it midstream to be like, oh, put on the brakes. We're going to change, because it doesn't work. So I'm glad we're doing it this way, slow and steady. And I'm excited for next year.
And what are the key differentiators? Like, how did you reposition? What are the key pillars that you've changed in terms of how you tell the story and package the messaging? I'm curious.
Yeah, for sure. If you look at Fabric's history, we're a composable commerce platform. And composable in this world means it's a bunch of different, think of it as applications on a platform that you can pick by themselves, or you can add a bunch of them together. It's headless. So like, we don't do the store, we don't do any of the front end stuff. So we just plug in. So it's a really big integration story, an API story. And there's a lot of folks that do that, right? We've got a bunch of competitors that do that, that have been around and have been doing it for a while. The interesting thing about our platform is that we have this order management system, which is all the back end stuff. So if you think of inventory fulfillment, and one of the big issues that we realized over these last 9 months is that the front end isn't necessarily connected to the back end. So how many times have you shopped at a store, whether it's on social, Instagram, TikTok, or even on the store site or the app? I won't say which brand always does this, but I have a favorite brand that this happens a lot. You order something and then 2 days later, you get an email that, oops, sorry, that's out of stock. How wonderful would it be if I, as a buyer, could actually see where the inventory is, right? So that doesn't happen. Or I could pick where I want the inventory or where I want that sent. And platforms today, it's usually cobbling a couple pieces together to get that real-time inventory. And what we realized is that's a huge pain point for folks. And if we could expose that information in a really clear way to not only like merchandisers and retailers, but to the actual customer, it will make for a better shopping experience. So what we've decided to do is really lean into that story from a pain point perspective versus what we were doing before, which was really technical, really around all the different pieces and how they fit together. So I'm excited to launch all of this stuff. We've also got a bunch of AI work that's gone into this that makes it even easier for folks to interact with the platform and really bring this message home as we get to NRF in January, which is retail's big show. But it's been a lot of meetings with a lot of friendlies, a lot of our customers, to really dig into what that big pain point is and crystallize it up into just a very simple story, which is connecting the demand side of the house to fulfillment, because those two things have never really been connected before seamlessly.
Yeah. And that just allows you, because if we're talking enterprise here, what is your average deal size?
So we're probably around 250,000, 175,000, somewhere in there, depending on size of company, et cetera.
We're talking to VPs and C-level, CIOs, CTOs. We're right in that range, right? So essentially, this is a massive decision. They come in, they'll compare you to your competitors. And the idea is really just not to be able to compare you in a spreadsheet to other players because you have a different value prop. And that's where you win. Like, it's just such a good way to go at it, to say like, hey, here's the other value prop that, you know, here's the story. And I think that's a solid way to crystallize it. And I'm curious what your idea for 2025 is looking like. Okay, now we've got this nailed down. Like, what does the strategy look like? You're probably right now planning that out. And
we're like, you know, in the middle of it. Yeah.
What are we? Give us an insider's peek.
Yeah, no. So I think for us right now, I call it the ground game. So it's working with the analysts, educating them, working with press to make sure they understand the new direction we're going in, and really starting to tell the story through our content, right? So how do we get out there and start to educate, be a thought leader, and something's got to be done differently in retail. And what is that, right? And I also think because of this AI buzz, everyone's talking about AI, but in retail, really trying to figure out what the use case is. I think we have an opportunity, and there's this void in the market. We have an opportunity to really own some of that share of voice. So we're doing a lot of that work now. And then as we look at that going into next year is, how does that consistently then show up at the events that we go to? What accounts are we trying to target? Let's make sure that message is in front of them with all of our ABM stuff. And like, how do we just consistently show up telling the same story? And that's probably going to take us through about mid-year, June. Retail's really heavy from an events perspective for the first part of the year. And that's normal, right? Because you think they're through their peak season. Right now, they're going to start looking at their budgets. I don't want to repeat the pain that I just went through during Black Friday or whatever it is. So they're going to start to look at technology for improvement and for efficiency. So that's where we're going to focus a lot of our energy. And then we'll see where we are mid-year and if we need to tweak anything or change kind of our strategy. But that's where I'm making my bets, is the analysts, PR, content, and ABM, like not doing a ton on Google AdWords until we really start to create that content.
That was my next question. What is your idea relative to digital? What does digital look like? Because that was event focus. We're changing as well in the analyst level, a lot of that shifting. What does it look like on the digital level? How do you think about that?
So I've deprioritized Google AdWords. LinkedIn will always have, because I think LinkedIn is just, it's where everybody is. It has gotten a little noisy. So our big objective is how to stand out from the crowd a little bit more. So what are we going to do there? But I think for me, I cut the Google AdWords budget by 60% for the last 6 months. And I have not seen a incremental decrease in the amount of leads I send over to sales. I actually see an increase in quality of what we get over because we've done the right targeting through ABM. Like our social, our organic social is through the roof. That is our number one lead generator for us because that's where we spend a lot of our time. But until I can't compete with Shopify, I can't compete with Adobe, I can't compete with Salesforce. I think for startups, especially in this digital landscape, it's trying to figure out how you can be creative and not try and spend a ton of money like everybody else, but really try and figure out where that money is going to be the most impactful. And then obviously, as we grow, like that might change, right? As the brand gets bigger, we do brand campaigns, probably invest more in branded keywords. But for now, that is not... The last company I was at, that was the number one line item, was digital spend on Google. Like the number one place that we spent money. And it was great because the company had been around 20 years. We were getting a lot of inbound. But for us, where we are today, that's not where I'm going to spend my money.
Which makes sense. You're not going to outcompete Adobe or Shopify in terms of Google ad spend. You're not just not going to win there. They can outspend you altogether. And I'm curious, because what is like your total addressable market in terms of number, give or take? What have you gotten that down to for your ABM strategy?
So for us, we look at it more as like number of accounts that we want to go after. So our sweet spot, if you think of Shopify, SMB, they're really going after, they're starting to go after like big enterprise. But that's not SMB is not necessarily where we want to compete. And then on the other side with Salesforce, Commerce Cloud, even big commerce, Hybris, which is now part of Oracle, Adobe, we're not really at the big enterprise level either. Our sweet spot is really the fast-growing enterprise or the fast-growing retailers. If you think about the stores that all came out and started online, Kate, Vuori, Allbirds, and now are starting to have stores. Once you start to get to different or multiple fulfillment locations, whether it's warehousing or physical stores, and you start to have more channels on the demand side, right? So not only are you doing an in-store, but you've got an app, you've got a website, you're doing stuff on social, you might be doing stuff on Amazon. right? It starts to increase the complexity and you need a more robust system. You can't just use Shopify. And I think that's where we're leaning towards is those types of brands that are growing fast and they need to have a modern system to support them as they grow. From a numbers perspective, I think we've got about 1,500 accounts that we're going after that we know fit that sweet spot.
Yeah. And I'm thinking like a lot of the people that come to you are obviously using a previous technology, probably Shopify or something like that. And now they're looking for, okay, we've got physical stores, we've got multiple inventory touch points, and it's becoming a mess to manage. We need a better solution. And then you integrate into that.
Yep. And the cool thing is with Shopify, it's that co-opetition thing, right? They don't necessarily have a robust OMS. So they could keep everything else on Shopify and they could just plug into our OMS, which would scale with them as they grow. Using an ERP system or using something out of the box that's going to break once you start to add multiple locations and multiple sources.
Yeah. And I want to pick your brain on that because I think you guys, given the account size and the way you're approaching it, like how do you think about account-based marketing? What is the stack there? What does it look like? How do you track your leads, your SQLs? Like, what does that look like from a very tactical implementation? Like, I'm curious to know what that looks like.
Our stack, this is probably, other than maybe one other company I worked for, is probably the leanest stack I've ever had in marketing, which is nice, right? It gets way less complicated when you can have a lean stack. We use HubSpot, we use Salesforce as our CRM, and we've got Sixth Sense, and that's pretty much it. So we are using Sixth Sense in the sense, funny, that we are using intent, right, from a sales perspective. We are using them from an advertising perspective and really starting to look at how we work with the sales team on the outbounding. So we've got a pretty small sales team. It's growing. Like we just got a new CRO about 3 months ago, which is great. So really working with him to say, okay, if these are the 2,000 accounts we're going after, how many accounts can a sales rep do outbound to realistically in a quarter? And then these are the marketing campaigns that we're going to run to those particular accounts. We're also going to do lighter stuff to other accounts that are going to be in waiting. So it's not like we're just focused on, let's say, 10 accounts per rep. We're doing all 2,000, but we're going to spend more money on the accounts that the reps are really working hard. So think of it as a bullseye, right? So if I've got 10 reps, they have 10 accounts each. That's the middle of the bullseye. I'm going to spend more per account on those. And then let's say they've got another 20 that are in waiting. That'll probably be their list next quarter. How do we then start to spend more money there, but not as much as we do at the middle of the bullseye? And that's an ongoing conversation we're having with sales to figure out, look, either we picked the wrong account. If it's not responding, the messaging might be wrong, or we don't have the right people in the database that we're trying to go after. So it's changed the conversation completely for us from how many MQLs do I hand over to let's strategize on what's working and what's not working to get in front of this account. And then you start to layer in events. Like right now we're getting ready for NRF, which is in January, which is like so hard because you lose people after Thanksgiving. So that's why we're starting so early. And it's okay, of those accounts that we said we were going after, we are going to start to put advertising in front of them about going to our party at NRF, booking a meeting, doing a demo before they get there, et cetera, so that when they pick up a phone and say, hey, let's have a meeting at NRF, it's all branded and consistent and we're telling the same story and they get that in-person touch point, which is so hard to get in today's world. So I think combining all of those pieces together is more important to me than the millions of pieces of tech we could probably buy to support it.
The tech is enabling. It's not like sometimes we have too many pieces of tech to do the work that we need to do. And I'm curious because it's a pretty intent heavy product. Obviously, all products are in the sense that are starting to feel the pain of this problem. Like you're looking for solution, right? So the intent is very important to your target. And I'm curious, what are the intent signals that you're looking for? Are you looking for new CIOs? What are the signals you're trying to hit home in this specific account-based marketing strategy?
Yeah, definitely. Any change of leadership, whether it be in e-com or merchandising or CIO, CDO, right, Chief Digital Officer, is something that's starting to become pretty common in the retail space, like somebody that kind of straddles between IT and the business to bring technology into the business. So I think those have always been a great intent signal. If you can get somebody, especially an executive, in their first 30 to 60 days at a new job, because they want to make change quick. And so if you can get in front of them like very quickly, they probably don't have a packed schedule. They're willing to talk to vendors. They're trying to get educated in the market. It's a great time to get something in front of them and help them make a decision.
It's best buying signal. Like, you can use all these intent engines and whatnot, but like, change in leadership is the best intent signal, period. Like, there is no better. Like, there's a bunch of things. What are they filling out in terms of forms, which white papers they've downloaded?
What are they searching?
Yeah. But the best one is change in leadership. If you've got a new VP or C-level person that's joining in the positions you're looking for, they're looking to drive change and they have influence and they were brought on to do something. So,
yeah. And the great thing is with LinkedIn, this to me really is the power of LinkedIn, is people, when they start a new job, they tell you.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Yeah, that's what's powerful.
So if you've got a list of accounts that you know, from an ICP standpoint, that you know would be a good fit, right? All you have to do is start listening to what's happening at the account. And if you can do that through intent, you're way more educated about the account versus how we used to do it, right? Like 20, even 15, 10 years ago, having a BDR sit there and just do Google searches for 8 hours a day. You know, now it's relatively easy. I remember 20 years ago when I was at Ariba, we had this tool called InsideView and it was very new and we used it all the time. Like, they literally had an alert that was set up if you had an account that you had flagged of a new chief procurement officer or a new CIO, and we would automatically send out a postcard and would say, congrats on your new job. We would love to meet with you. And the amount of people we would get inbounding were like, thanks for the note. Yeah, actually, I need a new procurement system. Ours isn't what we need. Would love for you to come in. That was our best campaign that we ever ran.
Yeah, best intent signal, period. That's it. Oh, after that, it's that budget planning and what's going on there is another. If you can get,
but you have to be a line item, right? Yeah. Then you have to be a line item in the budget. Yeah. So then you've got to get into the buying cycle, which is great about retail because it's pretty known, right? Like, they, from now until December, January, they're in code freeze. Like, they are just worried about all of the holiday shopping, the website's not going to break, inventory is there, et cetera, et cetera. So we've lost them from an attention standpoint till probably January.
Right now to change anything in retail at this time.
Unless something's completely broken, right?
Like, if they want an emergency situation. That's the only reason they contact you. That's interesting. So I guess, do you capture a lot of intent as well in these events? I mean, they probably give you a lot of information you can capture there. And I guess my second part is like, how good are these parties at converting clients?
Yeah, I think so. Look, parties, maybe this is my field marketing background. Parties and events to me are relationship building exercises, right? We did a dinner at this event in New York in June, and have I gotten pipeline from that dinner? I mean, it was 8 people. I probably spent $4,000 or $5,000 on it. CEO was there. Chief customer officer was there. So like, it was pretty heavy hitting on our side. And we had CIOs from retailers there. Have we gotten pipeline per se? Well, we've gotten obviously SQLs and they've shown intent. They want to talk to us. But it's not until I think last week, one of them popped up and was like, hey, you know what? Actually, we should have a conversation because this is a problem for me. Or it's a great way for us to also be like, hey, we've got this new AI functionality. We want to get some feedback on it. Would you be willing to hop on a call? To me, those are relationship building events. I've never thought of a dinner, a trade show as something that's going to get me instant pipeline.
No, you're not going to have them fill out a form at the end. No, that's not the case.
That would be great. That would be great if we could do that. But what it does is it builds relationships. It gives access to our executive suite. It lets us just show off our retail expertise because we've got a lot of retail ex-retailers in our C-suite as well. And so they get to have those conversations. And that could take a year to become a deal, but they've now become part of the family. And so when they get an email from us or they get an invite to something, they're like, yeah, sure, we'll go. It's got to be a healthy balance. You got to have some of that, but I also got to create some pipeline.
Exactly.
You know, you can't just do one.
Yeah. You can't be saying, oh, I'm building goodwill. That doesn't pay the bills. But it's one of these things. It's one of these future bets that always pays off because you get referred and then you get, that's the name of the game.
But I think it also allows them to get to know your brand, right? And I know this sounds corny, but fall in love with the brand, right? And what the brand represents, because the brand is about the humans that represent it as well, right? As much as it is about the color and the website and everything else. We really shine in that respect, right? Our parties, our dinners, they're fun, they're lighthearted, they're really great, unique venues, stuff people can't get into. And so if that becomes part of your brand, people are like, oh yeah, I remember that party at NRF last year. I'm definitely going to the one this year. That was super fun. It's also a way to establish that brand consistency with somebody that's not a piece of content. It's not digital. It's not your website.
Yeah. I'm curious, how much do you invest in one of these events?
I think for a dinner, it's usually around 5,000, depending on the size of it. For a bigger party, we're probably doing 25 to 30,000, depending on size.
Yeah. So you're taking Google, hosting more parties, net positive for the world. There you go.
And I think people now post-COVID, right? Yeah. Want to get back together. Yeah. They want to do stuff. Everybody likes being invited to a party, right? Yeah. Nobody wants to not be invited to a party. Yeah.
Agreed. And I'm curious, there's one question I had here because we talked about this last time, but what is one channel you'd like to spend more on if you could?
Honestly, for me, I mean, events, right? I would love to get to a point where we get to do events with celebrities. I worked at Domo in the heyday. We had amazing people come to our events. We did this super fun guerrilla marketing thing at Tableau's conference where we set up literally went in overnight and skinned a building outside of the exhibit. So it was their conference center. And the next morning it was all Domo in this middle sea of Tableau stuff, which was super fun. And then we had two parties at night. And the first night we had Flo Rida. So all you had to do was bring your badge from the Tableau conference. And then the next night we had Snoop Dogg. And it was free. And it was super fun to do. We spent a lot of money on it. Did we get a lot of pipeline out of it? No, but it was a fun stunt. So I would love to get back to that where I can spend money on that kind of stuff, right? Salesforce and Green Day, and they bring all of these great bands and very unique events that you wouldn't have access to. So that's one thing that I would love to do. And that goes back to my sports marketing background, right? The experience of it all. But I think from a practical standpoint, I think where most marketers tend to look at analyst relations as a tax on the business, right? Like you have to have a contract with Gartner. You have to have a contract with Forrester. It's just the price to be an enterprise SaaS, right? What I found, especially at a startup, if you can not spend more money, but spend more, resources and time on analysts and make stuff their idea so they can tell it to the market. If you think about what we're trying to do from a messaging standpoint and kind of not create a new category, but reshape it a little bit, the only people that are going to help us do that are going to be the analysts.
Which is fair, yeah, because they're guiding the decisions. Like at the end of the day,
people are going to listen. Yeah, exactly. And they can create the content, they can change the MQ, they can change the landscape. And so investing in that from a relationship building standpoint, as well as spending money to do reports and have them look at your business a little bit more. If I had an unlimited budget, I would spend more money there.
On the analysts and marketing to the
analysts. Because also they're the ones, perfect example, when I was at Fortress IQ and we created the process intelligence space, that category, we worked a lot with Gartner on this. And because it was like process mining and task mining were two separate things and we were trying to bring them together. And I'll always remember being on a briefing call and the analyst was like, you know what, this is really cool and very different. I'm actually getting on the phone with two pretty large enterprise companies in the next 2 days. I'm going to tell them about you. I'm going to send them your way because they should look at this. Who would have ever thought that an analyst would directly be a referral thing for you, right?
So how does it work? Gartner has essentially got these analysts. Obviously, they come out with these quadrants and they analyze everything. But these analysts are, I didn't know these analysts were also helping enterprise decision makers make decisions. So how does that work? Can you give me some light into that?
Yes. Think about like their subscription, right? So you have a subscription to Gartner. And when you're a tech company, right, like you're doing it in the sense of we're trying to educate the market and like place in the MQ and all that stuff. But people like big retailers or big enterprise companies are also subscribers to Gartner because they want them to come in and explain the market, right? Or I want to know the top three vendors for XYZ, help me make a decision. And so they have briefings on this kind of stuff, like how to solve a particular problem. So the more you can be in front of an analyst explaining what you're trying to do, they can be like, you know what? I was actually on a call with this vendor who's trying to crack this problem in a very unique way. You guys should talk to them. And it's not because we're on an MQ, right? Back then, fortunately, we were too small. Like we didn't meet the criteria to be an MQ, but they were a great referral network for us. And so I think that to me, because measuring analysts is always like this real kludgy process of, did you make it on the MQ? Did you move up and to the right? But I think the other way to look at it is how much referral business are you getting from the analysts? How much are they talking about you outside of the MQ in things like a hype cycle or in things like the cool vendor report or whatever? So I think a lot of SaaS companies focus on getting that MQ, but there's a lot more that analysts can bring to the table if you use them effectively.
And then how do you target analysts as like an addressable market? What is the strategy? You have your list of leads on LinkedIn, you hit them up, you run ads to them, you tell them your story. Is it like you're just like
You have to have a subscription, right? And they have different levels of subscriptions. And it's figuring out, like Gartner does a good job. They assign you somebody and you tell them the markets you're trying to serve and they match you up with analysts. And then you go through a bunch of briefings with them and bring them up to speed. They ask a bunch of questions and then you establish this rhythm around briefings. The best way to do it, at least at a minimum, is once a quarter, get in front of them with a product roadmap or a demo or something like that that they can react to. ADC is a little bit the same. You don't actually require a membership to brief them because they want to have a whole view of the market. And then Forrester, same kind of thing as Gartner. But there's also tier two and tier three analysts that talk about particular spaces like 451 Research is a tier two nucleus. There's a bunch out there that are a little cheaper than investing in a Gartner, but they are folks that people listen to because they are third party experts. And so think of it as influencers, right? Like these people are enterprise SaaS influencers. So how do you treat them as such? And an extension of that is there's a bunch of independent people that are influencers in the market. So that's another big tranche of what we're doing today is like, how do we get some of these influencers that are super vocal on LinkedIn to hear about us, know about us, and talk about us?
Yeah, influencer marketing on LinkedIn has exploded this year. We're a B2C company originally, and we do a lot of influencer marketing. And this year, we've done a lot of B2B influencer marketing just because now like software brands are starting to understand, oh, wow, there's actual influence that we can use to move. And it's all in that trend of people moving away from Google budget. That's what we're getting is here's a chunk of our Google budget that we want to put towards influencer. What does that look like?
Yeah. It's that age old tale of like B2B wanting to mimic B2C, right? I think we've gotten to that point where a lot of the B2C tactics are becoming even more relevant in B2B as we move into this kind of more digital world.
It's just people. At the end of the day, we're marketing to people. It's just
people. It goes back to communication, right? Like, how do you communicate with your buyers? How do they want to be communicated to? And who do they trust?
That's a wrap for me, Christelle. It was a real pleasure. Where can people find you?
Yeah, for sure. Check us out on fabric.inc. We've got a new website coming soon in the next couple of weeks. Definitely excited about that. So come check that out. But yeah, or you can hit me up on LinkedIn, just Christelle Flaho at Fabric.
This was a pleasure. Thanks for joining me today. And let's talk soon. Have a good one.
Yeah. Bye. Thanks so much, David.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Growth Notes. You can find links to all the resources mentioned in today's episode in the show notes. If you're finding value in our podcast, please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a 5-star review. It really helps us reach more listeners like you. Don't miss out on any insights. Keep listening and growing with us.